All right, we are going to go ahead and get started. This is going to be the second lesson on the medieval church. Last week we looked at the early medieval church. We looked at the role of monasticism. We looked at the rise of the early rise of the bishops of Rome. And we looked at this new relationship that the church was having to forge with society. That's going to be the first slide, by the way, just to rehash where we were last week. A lot of the mission and the monastic movements are going to be, the Benedictine movement is going to be based around missionary work in Germany and in England. Now, the characteristics of what we call the High Middle Ages, which is the period that we're going to be studying this week, are going to be relatively the same. We're going to be talking about the same types of thing. We're going to be talking about, instead of just the beginning of the papacy, we're going to be talking about its zenith, its peak of its power and its influence and the claims that it makes on society and on the church. We're also not just going to be talking about Benedictine monks anymore, but we're going to be talking about a wide range of new monastic orders that are going to be developed during this time. And those are going to be developed for societal reasons. Stresses in society and changes in society are going to mandate that the monastic arm of the church kind of diversify itself. And then we're going to be talking about the rise of universities and scholasticism. So when we think about the High Middle Ages, these are typically what we think of. We think about popes rivaling kings, deposing emperors. We think about monks going all over the place. We think about Franciscans. We think about Dominicans. You might know about Cistercians and Carthusians, the Templars, the Hospitaller Knights. We're going to talk about all of these, at least briefly. And then probably finally, we think about the rise of scholasticism in universities. So famous questions like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin are going to be things that the scholastics are going to be talking about. Now, we can laugh about that, but there are going to be reasons why they think about these things. And that's not just going to be some esoteric just question that they're going to seek to deal with. They are going to believe that it has real implications. So let's look at the scope and the spread of Christianity at the time of the High Middle Ages. We can go to the next slide for that. All right, so everything that you see in purple, pink, and yellow is going to be what we talked about up until last time. The brown areas are going to be areas that are Christianized during the time of the early Middle Ages. So you see Britain, the majority of Britain is Christianized, and then large sections of Germany are going to be Christianized as well. That's the western part of Germany anyway. And then this week, all the green is going to be Christianized. Now, we won't get to talk about a lot about, especially the Christianization of Russia and things like that. We're going to have to not deal with that because that's more of an Eastern church thing. But that's going to happen during this time. Cyril and his brothers are going to go to the Bulgars and write their alphabet. And then that's going to spread on into Russia as the Vikings invade Russia and form a principality in central Russia around the city of Kiev. They're going to send representatives both to Rome and Constantinople and going to become Christianized. Also, Scandinavia and the Vikings and the Poles and the Czechs and a number of other people in Central Europe and Northern Europe are going to be Christianized at this time period through the works of monks. Same as in the early Middle Ages. Now, what Europe looked like politically during this time period is a little odd to us. We're going to have during this period the beginning of nation states, and that's going to play a role in it. But we have really a lot of areas that are odd to us. If you know a modern map of Europe, you can know where the countries are, but we see a lot of different areas that aren't going to be noticed, known to us. Burgundy in kind of in between France and Italy. This big thing in the middle is going to be the Holy Roman Empire. It's going to be made up of a lot of little independent or semi-independent principalities. England is unified at this time period, and France becomes unified at this time period. And they're going to be the two that are really going to play kind of a key role along with the Holy Roman Empire in our history of this time period. Now, political philosophy at this time is going to revolve around a system of government called feudalism. And the early Middle Ages really doesn't have feudalism. Feudalism only develops after the destruction of Charlemagne's empire and these invasions that are going to take place. strong central kings are no longer able to do the things that kings need to do. Protect their people, dispense benefits and gifts and things like this. And so a new structure is going to develop in which the king is still going to be at the head of our hierarchy here, but it's going to involve an interlocking system of oaths and obligations that in which the king is going to dispense power in the form of land or influence, and then the people that he dispenses power to will then swear oaths of loyalty and obligation to bring troops or to come when he needs them or to supply him with certain money or hospitality. And then those lords will then in turn do the same thing to lesser lords, and those lords all the way down till you get to the lowest knights and the lowest manors, in which you'll have the people that work on all of this and support all of this is going to be the serfs, these people at the bottom who are farming and tending the land. So that's kind of the political situation at the time. Now, Europe, not just is changing as far as political theory goes and different things like that, but it's also changing in a number of other ways. And this is going to be a lot of what drives the development of what we would call the high medieval church, is this change that's undergoing in society. As society changes, the church and the structure of the church and the way that the church thinks about how it relates to the world and the way that it has to go about relating to the world is going to change. So one of the most important things that happens during this time period is going to be the Mediterranean Sea, which had really been cut off from most of Western Europe by the invasions of Islam in Spain and in southern France, and then the Byzantine control of most of Italy. So most of what we would consider Western Europe, France, Germany, England, is really cut off from the Mediterranean Sea, and this is going to depress trade. So once this opens up with the reconquest of Charlemagne of France and then parts of Spain, and then the Byzantines losing their grip on Italy, this is going to allow Western Europe once again to have access to the Mediterranean Sea, and it's going to allow them to start expanding their trade routes back into what we would consider the ancient Near East. So here's what the trade routes look like in 737. So not a lot happening in Western Europe. You'll notice this. Not a lot. You have some Frisians. Those would be the what we consider the modern Netherlands. Some routes there. Not a lot else. Most of our activity is concentrated still in the East. Next, by the time we get to about the beginning of the 13th century, we've noticed that a lot of industrial cities or cities like Cologne and Paris and even Novgorod up in Russia are appearing, and then also more cities in Italy, Milan, Genoa, Venice, which has always been around, but also Florence and Naples. And then by the time we get to the end of the time period we're talking about, so about the beginning of the 16th century, you'll notice how greatly trade has expanded. And this is all going to influence in the rise of trade, and then the corresponding things that that's going to bring to Western Europe is going to force the church to kind of think about itself in a lot of different ways. Another thing that's going on during this time period that's going to revolutionize life is going to be an agricultural revolution takes place. So whereas before, farming technology really hadn't changed a whole lot in Western Europe, since really basic primitive farming things, they were still using plows that just barely scraped the surface. They had to cross plow pieces of ground multiple times. If you had pieces of ground that hadn't been plowed before, it took a lot of work to dig up the ground. Then new farming methods are going to be developed. They're going to move from a two-field system to a three-field system that's going to increase production. New farming technology like this kind of plow right here, it's called a heavy plow that's actually going to dig into the ground and turn the ground over instead of just scraping the surface, is going to allow for much better and faster plowing. And then all of this is going to lead to a population increase, which is, of course, going to fuel, along with the trade, the increase of cities and the rise of cities. So this is going to lead to, we don't need to think for a second that the majority of people still didn't live on farms, but more and more people are moving to cities as the agricultural ability to produce food increases, and you need less and less people to produce the same amount of food or even more food. That leaves, with the population increase, a lot of people that don't have anything to do. And these people are going to naturally flock to cities, which at this time are going to begin becoming places where a lot of this excess that's being produced agriculturally is going to be taken and it's going to be used. And Europe is going to become a famous, Mostly textiles, wool and fabric and different things like that are going to be the major things that happen as far as exports go, along with some other mining and other things like that that's going to take place later in the medieval period. But you're going to have these rise of cities. And the cities are going to win their freedom from local lords, and they're going to do this by appealing to kings and to the popes. And they're going to become centers of trade and industry. And this is going to be a problem because the church, really up until this time period, especially in the Middle Ages, is a very rural institution. The great centers of learning and power within the church are the monasteries. The monasteries exist in the countryside. They have to. They have to have large amounts of land to support themselves. They're not going to be in the cities. And so this is going to lead these new cities to really be almost unchurched in a lot of ways, and unreached. And that's going to lead to the development of a number of monastic institutions. Now, we have the rise of nation states. France and England during this time period are going to consolidate themselves around powerful kings. You have people like, well, we'll talk about some of them at least briefly. Philip the Fair or Philip IV in France, Henry II in England are going to unify their countries and really be able to exert more and more influence. This is one of the things that weak kings bring about, is that the church kind of fills in that vacuum. But as kings get stronger, they're going to start seeking to take a lot of the power that they had lost during this period back. And that's going to lead to conflict between the church and the state. Now, all of this eventually, unfortunately, is going to collapse. And there's going to be three major reasons why this happens. The mini ice age, or climate change, takes place during this time period. This is going to begin in about the late 13th century, and it's going to last all the way up until the beginning of the 19th century. So it's during this time period that you'll hear things about the Thames River in London freezing over. The King of Sweden is able to march over the ice from Denmark all the way out to the islands where Copenhagen is and destroy the Danes. Also things like, did I have anything else? Oh, glaciers are going to appear in the Swiss Alps and start overrunning Swiss villages. So as climate gets colder and colder, a lot of the agricultural production and a lot of the land that had been used in Europe is no longer going to be able to produce things. And actually, more land is under agricultural production in Europe during the 13th century than is even under agricultural production even today. So, and then you have war. You're going to have the Hundred Years' War that takes place between England and France that's going to disrupt society. This is a picture of the French king being captured by the English king at the Battle of Poitiers. And then you have the Black Death, which is going to come along. And it's going to destroy, probably now estimates range between 40 and 50% of Europe's population. So somewhere between 30 and 45 million people over the course of about a four-year period will die in Europe. All right. So all of this is going to lead us. This is kind of the philosophical or the political an economic background to what we're going to be talking about. And into this period of rising trade, agriculture, growth in Europe, the popes are going to become major players. Now, we talked about early papal claims last week. You have the successor of the apostles. He's the mouthpiece of Peter. He's the first among all the bishops. His approval is needed for councils to be official. He must approve archbishops. And this new thing that's going to develop at the very end of the time period that we talked about last week is going to be this donation of Constantine. You might have heard about this before. This is a document that the popes had that in which they claimed, anyway, that Constantine had given not just the authority of the Western Church to the popes, but actually had given the authority of the Western emperors to the church as well. And so the pope was able to give this authority then to who he wanted. And one of those, that was Constantine. Now, we know later, during the time period of the Renaissance, this was proven to be a forgery. Probably during the middle of the 8th century, so about 50 or 60 years probably before Constantine was crowned emperor, this would have been forged. Now, we need to understand a couple of things before we just get on to them about forging the document, is that their views of forging and our views of forging are going to be very different. They would have lived in a time period when many things that they knew had existed at one point didn't exist anymore because of war or, you know, Rome had been sacked a number of times. Things had been burned. Things had been lost. They really believed this thing existed. And so what you do when you really believe something exists that you want to exist is you create it and you pass it on. It was a willful deception in the fact that they were creating something they knew to be wrong, but it wasn't a willful deception and they were creating something that they didn't believe to be true. So it's a little bit different. Now, after these early papal claims, there's going to be a period of papal weakness. Oh, and here's some accomplishments here. They're going to establish political power in central Italy, missions to England and Germany. They're going to reform the French church, and they're going to establish a new Roman Empire. All these are the accomplishments of the early popes. Now, after these early accomplishments, we're going to get to a period of weakness. And this is going to be brought about by a couple of things. Three, in fact. And these are going to be, they're going to be threatened from within and from without. So what I mean by this is they're going to be at the mercy of emperors, either Western or Eastern, that are going to seek to control them for their own purposes, or they're going to be at the mercy of the Italian nobles that are going to be in the city and around the city of Rome. So they're going to really be at the mercy of these threats. And until they can find some effective counterbalance for these threats, that situation's not going to change. Now, they make a mistake, obviously, in creating one of these threats themselves by crowning Constantine as emperor. They're creating a balance of power that's kind of equal to them. And in some ways, if you look at the donation of Constantine, it's actually greater than them. Constantine's the one who gives them, the popes, this power. So if you create a new Roman emperor, aren't you, in fact, creating a superior? So this is going to be a problem. And in fact, later popes, as we get further and further into the Middle Ages, are going to talk less and less about the donation of Constantine. And talk about that less and less because they're going to recognize this problem. And you're just going to have a number of weak popes that are going to exist. And not just weak popes, you're going to have stories of very, very immoral popes and popes that do a number of evil and wicked things, and that's not going to do the papacy any favors. Now, when we talk about the rise of the medieval papacy, this period that we're going to be talking about, it really starts with one man. It's going to start with Leo the Ninth. And the reason why it starts with Leo the Ninth, because a lot of the things that we associate with the medieval papacy are going to begin with him, either intentionally or unintentionally. So a lot of this, we talked about the problems of threats to the papacy from within and without. He's going to solve this by unwittingly and unintentionally making an alliance with the Normans. Now, the Normans are a very interesting group of people. We probably don't have enough time to talk all. We don't have enough time to talk about them hardly at all. But these are going to be the same people that are going to appear in northern France and are going to conquer England. This is another group of them that are going to end up in southern Italy and actually conquer the kingdom of what would become the kingdom of Naples. They're going to actually conquer the island of Sicily as well. And the Pope is going to form an alliance with the Byzantines to try and get rid of these guys. And unfortunately, the Normans are better soldiers than his soldiers are. And he's defeated and the Pope is actually captured by the Normans. And so the Normans pretty much forced the Pope into forming an alliance with them. Now, and recognizing their right to hold this land in southern Italy. Now, what the popes don't realize, what looks like a disaster to Leo at first, is actually going to be a benefit to him because they're going to prove the effective counterbalance to the imperial Germans and the Byzantines. And the Pope is really going to be able to use his alliance with the Normans to kind of gain his political independence from both of these people. Now, also during the time of Leo IX, we have the schism, the final break between the Eastern and Western churches, where you have Leo's legates going to Constantinople, and in the middle of Mass and the Church of Hagia Sophia putting down a bull of excommunication and walking out and shaking the dust off their feet. So we have this that happens, but he's also going to reform church practice in a lot of ways. During this period of weak popes, kind of standard life of the church that a lot of the medieval popes had really worked, early medieval popes had really worked to make standard, had kind of fallen in, had kind of lapsed. And so he's going to enforce once again papal celibacy. He's also going to enforce the no simony, you cannot pay for church office. These kind of things are going to be done away with. And he's also going to reform the papal government. And this is going to be important because a lot of what we think about as terms as far as the popes go are going to be the ways in which the popes governed. And they're going to do this in three ways. They're going to do this through the calling of councils, through papal legates, which are just going to be people that the Pope sends to a certain country or to a certain place, and he gives them a job, and they are pretty much empowered by all the power of the popes to do whatever they see fit in this place. So they can call councils, they can depose bishops, they can excommunicate patriarchs, supposedly. And then another thing that he's going to do is he's going to write letters. Now, Leo is going to begin doing all of these. So he's going to travel throughout Western Europe, whereas popes had pretty much remained in Italy and in Rome up until this point. Leo's going to be a great traveler. He's going to travel all around Western Europe. He's going to call local councils to resolve issues. He's also going to be important in sending legates, like we've seen, as far as Constantinople and excommunicating people, even though they probably did that without... I mean, Leo was dead by the time that they did this, so the actual bull of excommunication then becomes invalid, which has been helpful to the Catholic Church as it's now seeking to reestablish relationships with the Eastern Church. And then letters. Leo is going to triple the output of letters that he writes opposed to his predecessors. So as where we have probably maybe 9 or 10 copies a year of letters written by Leo's predecessors. We're going to have 30 copies from Leo. By the time we get to Innocent III, we're going to have 280 letters. And by the time we get to the end of this period with John the 23rd, we're going to have over 3,500 letters that remain from John the 23rd. So you see just the massive building that goes on in papal administration. Now, councils between 680 and 900, there are three recognized Western councils that take place. Then, for the next, from 900 to 1100, for the next 200 years, there are zero. So during this time period of papal weakness, there are no ecumenical councils called at all that are officially recognized in the West. And then in the period from 1100 to about 1300, we have eight. So we have this massive movement of the church to push its influence on the church as a whole by calling these councils that are really going, they're going to seek. During these, this isn't a council like we should think of as Nicaea, where the bishops are kind of getting together, kind of to decide an issue. What it is the Pope comes with a set of agendas and the bishops just check them off. Yes, 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 yes. So that's what's going to happen in these. And then from the period after 1300 to 1400, there are zero again. And then we get a renewed burst of councilor activity in the time period to end the Great Schism and leading up to the Reformation. But that's going to be, we see, really the activity of the church in calling these councils. Okay? So now, because of all of this, the Pope was really able to distance himself from both Germans and Greeks. He used the Normans as a counterbalance. And the popes were able, during this time period, to kind of wrestle away the power of their election. So how the popes were elected, they were kind of able to win that power back for themselves. That had been seized by the German emperors. Otto the First will say, you know, I will let the popes have as much freedom as they want to as long as they do what I want them to do. And I'm here to kind of oversee and kind of look at the pope and make sure that the election goes according to plan and nothing bad happens, which means no one's elected that I don't like. So that's kind of what's happening. So the popes in 1059, right about the time that these councils begin, is really going to able to kind of gain that power back for themselves. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, the real source of papal power during this time period isn't going to be anything really that the popes can do. It's that people want to come to the pope. People from across Europe desire to come to the pope because he can give them two specific things that they need. And that all great lords during the Middle Ages gave. All great lords during the Middle Ages give two things. They give benefits or gifts, and they dispense justice. And so because the Pope could do these things, and because he was the highest church official, so his justice was the highest, we just go to the Pope. And because he's able to give a number of benefits, like he can free monasteries from being controlled by bishops, he can grant them certain privileges of when they can eat, you know, certain things and do certain things like that, kind of let them get out of the rule a little bit in certain situations, or dispensations for different things like, oh, you're a priest and you had an illegitimate child, well, let me take care of that for you, type of thing. So he can do all those types of things. So this is going to lead to this pope gaining power, not because of necessarily anything that the pope's actively doing trying to seek this, but just because people naturally want to come to the source where power is, and that's just going to lead to more and more and more power. All right. So now this new source of power is going to lead to some pretty audacious claims, and they're going to stem from one of Leo's secretaries who later becomes pope. His name is Gregory the Seventh. So we can just run through a couple of these. What are some of the things that the papacy at this time period when they're gaining power claim? Popes can be judged by no one. That's a pretty Pretty audacious claim. No one can judge a pope. He's above judgment. And really what the popes are doing here is they're going way out. They're going to claim as much power as they possibly can, and they're going to see where they get a pushback from, and that's the amount of power that they're going to grab, however much they can. All right? The Roman Church has never erred and will never err. The Roman Church was founded by Christ alone. The Pope alone can depose and restore bishops. He alone can make new laws and set up bishops and divide old ones. He alone can call general councils and authorize canon law. He alone can use the imperial insignia. He can depose emperors. He can absolve subjects of their allegiance. All princes must kiss his feet. And the Pope is undoubtedly made a saint by the merits of Saint Peter. So, and that's not even all of them that Gregory makes. That's just a smattering or a good rundown of them. So he's going to make more. And Gregory's really going to be doing this because he's involved in a controversy. He's having to make these very audacious claims because he's in the middle of a fight. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Is the expansion of papal power and the removal of that power from kings, up until this time, kings had been the one to appoint bishops. Now think about that. What do you get by appointing a bishop? Well, the person you appoint probably will pay you a handsome fee for being appointed bishop. And when he dies, which usually you appoint bishops that are pretty old, so they turn over relatively quickly, that's a pretty steady stream of income. It's also a very easy way in which you can dispense gifts. This power that kings have, right? The power that kings have comes from giving gifts. This is why the Merovingians and the Carolingians eventually fall, because they don't have this power anymore. They've squandered all their resources. And so, to do this, the kings want that power. And the popes want that power, because once again, they're fighting over this source of power, this ability to give gifts. And bishoprics are big gifts to give. So, we're going to have three major conflicts between kings and religious figures. We're going to have Gregory the VII and Henry the IV. That's going to be the pope and the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. We're going to have Henry the II, the King of England, and Thomas Becket. And then Boniface VIII, who's the Pope, and Philip IV, who's the King of France. So these are going to be the big conflicts. We probably won't be able to talk about them all, but if you want to do some reading, these are the big ones that developed during the Middle Ages. All right? So it's now the controversy that's going to come up, and this is probably the most important one between Henry and Gregory, is going to be the investiture controversy. Who's going to appoint a bishop? And the way that this begins is that Henry IV is created emperor when he's 6 years old. So he has no power. So the popes are going to seize all the power, and the church is going to seize all the power that they can from the emperor. This is going to be when they establish the College of Cardinals, which elects the pope. So no longer is the emperor going to be able to elect the pope. The cardinals are going to elect the pope. They're also going to seize the ability to appoint bishops. And when Gregory makes these claims, Henry has just come into manhood, pretty much. And so Henry's going to start pushing back. And what he does is he's going to assemble a synod of German bishops, and he's going to depose Gregory at the synod. And he says, I, Henry, king by the grace of God, with all my bishops say to you, come down and be damned throughout the ages. That's what he says to Gregory in his letter to him, telling him that he's been deposed. Now, Gregory is going to push back. He's going to excommunicate Henry. And excommunication, obviously, he's going to be removed from the church. It also absolves all of his subjects from any sort of allegiance to him. Now, this only works if the subjects want to be absolved, which they did. And so, Henry's nobles are going to take this religious cover that the excommunication gives them and rebel. And this is going to put Henry into a very awkward sense because the Pope at this time is moving north to convene a new council that's going to depose Henry permanently and elect a new emperor. So Henry has to cut him off. He meets the Pope at the castle of Canossa in northern Italy and stands for 3 days barefoot in the snow outside the castle, begging for forgiveness. Now, Gregory is going to really be forced against his better judgment to kind of forgive Henry for political reasons. He feels like he's in a weakened political situation. He's not in Germany where the nobles are backing him. He's kind of in Italy. Henry has some friends there. So he's forced to forgive him. Now, as soon as this happens, Gregory feels like he's won. Everything that Gregory's wanted, Henry agrees to. And then Henry heads north. defeats the rebels and then invades Italy and captures Rome. And the Pope himself is forced to lock himself up in his castle in Rome. So he's a prisoner, basically, of Henry. And now this is where his friendship with the Normans is going to come in handy. He's going to send for the Normans. The Normans are going to come. They're going to expel Henry. But in the process, they're going to sack and burn most of Rome. This is not going to make the Roman people too happy with Gregory. Gregory is forced to leave Rome. And he dies shortly thereafter. And his famous last words are, "I have loved justice and hated iniquity. Therefore, I die in exile." So this is kind of what's going on. So there's not really a clear victor again. Now, the Pope is going to end up as the kind of come out ahead in this. But it's not going to be a very strong victory. And so it's going to allow for later for this to kind of get overturned. And that's going to happen not that long afterwards with Boniface and Henry. So here's the decline of the papacy is going to really involve this conflict that develops between Boniface and Philip. And it's going to lead to the Babylonian captivity of the papacy. And it's also going to eventually lead, because the Babylonian captivity is going to lead us to the Great Schism, in which at one point we're going to have three rival people, all claiming to be the Pope, all excommunicating each other, and various parts of Europe, for political reasons, not religious reasons, allying themselves one with one or the other of these three guys. So we could talk very briefly, perhaps, about this. But it's going to involve, once again, religious authority inside a kingdom. Philip IV is going to be famous for a number of things, none of them really good. But he's going to be famous for really unifying France. He's really one of the last of the Capetian kings. These are the guys that take over from the Carolingians. They're the Counts of Paris. And this is one reason why Paris is going to become the capital of France. But anyway, he's going to consolidate his rule in France by lying and by political maneuvers. And he is the master of just underhanded dealing. He's the guy who's going to get rid of the Templar Knights through accusing them of all types of crimes just because he owes them millions and millions of dollars and doesn't want to pay. So he's like, what can we do? Oh, yeah, we can get rid of them. He's going to do the same thing with the papacy. He wants to tax the French clergy is what he wants to do. Once again, he's chronically short of money. He wants to tax the French clergy. Boniface says, no, you can't do that unless I let you. And Philip says, oh, yes, I can. And not only am I not going to, I'm going to tax the French church, all the money that I would normally send to you, I'm now going to outlaw. And so Boniface is really forced to cave. He needs the French money to support the papal government. He doesn't get it. He's running out of money, so he's forced to cave in. And not only that, but Philip is actually going to send people. They're going to kidnap Boniface. They're going to beat him and almost execute him. And then they're going to throw him out, and he's going to die very shortly thereafter, a couple of days, weeks. And in this threat where the previous pope has just been captured and almost executed, the cardinals are very smartly going to elect a Frenchman, a friend of Philip's, as the new pope, and he is going to promptly relocate himself from the papal states down here in central Italy to the city of Avignon, which is right here on the border of France and in the south. So he's going to move very close to France, and the papacy is going to remain there for the next 70 odd years, where you're going to have a number of popes, all of them French, are going to be there. All right, so this is going to lead us to issues. And the real issue that's going to develop during this time period is the Pope's going to cease to be a religious leader. He is going to become a secular leader and a business leader. Every Pope between the years, every Pope for a number of years is going to be a lawyer. It's for about a 150-year period. Every single one of them is going to be a lawyer. So this really shows you where the emphasis of the church is going to be. It's going to be on running this kind of government. Here's a quote from Bernard of Clairvaux. We probably don't have time to go over it, but he's talking to his disciple who has become the Pope, and he's saying, don't worry about the running of the business, right? Let me be like a Jethro to your Moses. You know, your purpose is not settling all these little ticky-tack decisions that the papacy is really worried about. It's being a religious leader. That's your purpose. Your purpose is reforming the church and spiritually leading the church, not settling cases that involve, the Pope would send bishops off to settle cases of which parish belonged to which episcopate, and for the process of £10 maybe, a revenue of £10, the Pope would be able to command bishops to move there and settle that. So it's just very odd. Now, the next big thing that happens during the Middle Ages we're going to be able to run through this very briefly, is the proliferation of monastic orders. Now, this is caused by, one, the decline of the Benedictines. Now, the Benedictines themselves are going to be reformed, and they're going to be reformed in really two ways. And this is going to lead to new orders are going to be created by a changing social system. So as Europe's population explodes, Europe's going to push out and colonize a lot of the rest of Europe. And so you're going to have a lot of monks that are kind of the forefront of that colonization process. Also, as cities expand, you're going to have monks that are specifically geared to being in cities, a number of them, to preach and become pastors inside of cities that normally wouldn't have had people. So spread of monasticism, this is the early spread of monasticism. It spreads from Egypt to Rome and France and then to Ireland and then back to France. And then we have the different orders. So the Benedictines are really going to be reformed at Cluny. The monastery at Cluny in central France is going to be one of the important reformers of the Benedictine monasteries. And also the Cistercians. The Cistercians are going to be these monks who go out into the wilderness. And they're going to be responsible really for clearing and settling a lot of the wilderness areas of Europe. They're going to go and establish hundreds and hundreds of monasteries in wilderness areas, and they're going to bring order to it. You have the Carthusians, which are going to be a very, very strict sort of a combination of hermits and communal monks. They're going to live by themselves almost entirely, but occasionally come together. They're the only ones that have never been reformed, the only monastic order that has never been reformed, ever. You have the Augustinian canons. These are going to be the guys who go into the cities among them. You're also going to have Dominicans and Franciscans, which are going to be mendicant friars, begging friars, who are going to go into the cities as well. And then you have a number of other lesser orders, lay orders like the Beguines and the Brotherhood of the Common Life. And then you have military orders, the Teutonic Knights in Germany, the Templar Knights and the Hospitaller Knights that are going to be important during the Crusades. So these kind of monk knights that are going to go and take monastic vows and yet fight for Christ and do all these things against the heathens. So these are just, you can just see the great wealth of different types of monks that there are. Next slide. This is a pilgrimage route. This is one of the reasons why Cluny became so important. Cluny was strategically located along the pilgrimage route. Next slide. And this is the spread of the Clunic monasteries are in red. The Cistercian monasteries are in blue. By the time that Henry VIII dissolves the monasteries in Britain, there are over 800 monasteries, monastic houses, just in Britain, 800. All right. And now, finally, let's look at the role of scholasticism plays in this period. All right, so the coming of scholasticism is really going to be based in a three-step process. So we're going to move from monastic schools. This is very, very early Middle Ages. We have the monks that are going to be the repository of knowledge and learning in the early Middle Ages. And they're going to be in the countryside, not in cities. This is where you go if you want to learn how to read and write. You become a monk, and this is what you do. Now, that's going to change as cities begin to grow and as bishops begin to set themselves in these cities around their cathedrals that are going to be built during this time period are going to start forming schools. And around these schools, people in the cities are going to come. And they're going to start coming not to the monasteries, but they're going to start coming into the cities. And they're going to stay there and they're going to learn. And now around the greatest of these cathedral schools are going to develop with the medieval universities. The most famous of these are going to be at Paris, at Oxford, at Bologna in Italy. And these are going to develop. And you can see the spread of medieval universities. These are the medieval universities by about the middle of the 1400s. And you see how many of them have spread from these first three that are going to develop really in Paris is in the 1100s, Oxford's in the 1100s. So from very, very early on, they're going to develop and spread all over Europe. And these are just universities. There are going to be a number of other colleges and schools that are going to develop in other major towns as well. And what are the causes of scholasticism? Why does this happen? Why do these universities develop? Well, basically, it's going to be, once again, it's going to be demand. Just like papal power develops because of demand for it, education and universities are going to develop because of demand. This new urban society, new nation states, the growing papal administration need educated people. They need lawyers. They need theologians. They need people that understand and are able to write and reason and be statesmen and be ambassadors and different things like that. And so they need educated people, both for the church and the state. And then primarily for scholasticism, and the return to scholasticism is going to be the rediscover of Aristotle's text. Now, these have been lost in the West for a long time. They're going to be rediscovered basically through contact with Muslims in Spain and through the Crusades. So by going to the East, where Aristotle was never lost, to Constantinople and to the Arabs, which had written a number of texts, people like Averroes and a number of other people had written texts on Aristotle, and really developed a very early form of scholasticism that was based on Islam instead of Christianity, a way of understanding rationally the world, this is what's going to cause scholasticism, this contact with the East. Now, the main thing I want you to get out of scholasticism is going to be the way that people kind of relate to the world and relate to this kind of difference between faith and reason. So people like Anselm of Canterbury or Augustine are going to say something like this: I believe so that I may understand. So I have faith, and then that allows me to understand the physical world. So faith is kind of the basis for reason. All right. Now you're going to have a person that comes along by the name of Peter Abelard. And he's going to create a radical break with this. And Abelard is going to say, he doesn't actually say this, but this is kind of what he says. This is what he believes. I understand in order that I may believe. I have to understand it first. I have to rationally be able to wrap my mind around it. And only then will I believe it. So if it's not rational, if it's not believable, I can't believe it. And it's going to be a very, very, very big break. And Abelard is going to be condemned as a heretic by, among others, Bernard of Clairvaux. And he's going to have him kicked out of the church. But eventually we're going to have... Abelard is a very famous, probably the most famous teacher at the University of Paris at the time. We have evidence of thousands and thousands of people would come to Paris and gather to hear him teach. We also, after he's even kicked out of the University of Paris, he's forced to go in the countryside. We have students that would just follow, hundreds and hundreds of students that would just follow him out in the countryside to hear him teach. He's also going to begin the kind of the way that scholastics write. They would write a problem or have a problem and then propose a solution to it, and then write a counter-argument to that solution, and kind of this very systematic working out of what they believed. And Abelard is going to be among the first to do that. Now, the guy that's really going to be the pinnacle of this, though, is going to be Thomas Aquinas. And this is going to be the synthesis, really, that Aquinas is going to say, is that there is faith and reason can't disagree. But it's together that they're going to work to understand and bring us to a knowledge of God. So what we're going to do is there can be no ultimate conflict between faith and reason. They are going to work together to do this. And he's going to write his famous Summa Theologia, which is going to be, it's about 60 volumes long, I think. If you get the English and Latin translation together, it's humongous. It wasn't finished by the time that he died. There are numbers of famous stories about Aquinas and his ability and his intellectual prowess. He could keep four different stenographers going at the same time on four different things. He would get up at the middle of an important dinner and just say, I got it, and just walk off and just go and work on whatever he had suddenly found the solution for. So he's very famous. And Aquinas' kind of synthesis of faith and reason is really going to be the basis. And a lot of what Aquinas does in his Summa is really going to end up, especially as we go on, and two, the age of the Reformation and everything, it's going to become the basis for Catholic Church theology and teaching on a number of things. His view on transubstantiation, his view on justification, are all going to be, in the end, the views that are accepted by the Catholic Church and remain standard church teachings within the Catholic Church. So he's going to be very, very important. All right. Now, I have a little bit extra, but before I go on anywhere else, we're really right almost at time. If anyone has any questions about the High Middle Ages, I'll be happy to answer those. Yes?
How do we understand the role of God's sovereignty in this period of the church, in that it's very, I guess you could call it, corrupt and secular, and far from what we would envision the church of the New Testament?
Oh, so the idea of how do we understand God's sovereignty in this? That's an interesting question. I think from a historian's point of view, one of the things we can look at that, but we want to be kind of careful with trying to understand what God's doing at any point, because we just obviously as humans can't know. But if we're looking at this and we just want to maybe make a couple of guesses about how God's using this time period, really what we see is at no point, probably ever in human history, was one culture as saturated with belief in God as the medieval culture was. So from the top to the bottom, it was saturated in Christianity. Now that might have been a form of Christianity we might not always agree with theologically. That might be a kind of Christianity that we realize has significant problems. That's true. But as far as just the everyday working out of the gospel, there are numbers of people that were monks who were very devout, who took the gospel to people that suffered martyrdom in faraway places that died. When we have the tale of the Black Death, you have a number of monks and members of the church who would just go and minister to the people who had the plague and care for them and get the plague and die. So we have a number of things now, and it's just like any society. It's going to have its problems. But as far as God's sovereignty, what we really see is that this area is really sad. Now, there are a lot of problems, obviously, with it. But I think that it's really hard to sit there and say, what do we think God is doing in this area? We have a lot of period where, you know, you have people like in Germany where Martin Luther is going to eventually become. You have reform movements that crop up inside of these things. You have people like the Augustines who are going to go around, or the Augustinian monks who are going to go around and take the gospel to the cities and different things like that. So you have good and bad, just like you're going to have in any time period whatsoever. It's just, I think it's a lot easier for us to criticize, obviously, the further back we go, because we can see all the problems very, very clearly, and we can see how all the problems are getting out of control. I don't think a lot of the people at the time, this is one of the things I want you to, maybe a picture that I want to give you for the Catholic Church anyway. The Catholic Church is going to make a number of mistakes, theologically, practically, a number of different ways. And the thing with the Catholic Church is, because of what Gregory the VII said back towards the beginning, the church can never err and will never err. The church is really locked in once it makes a decision to, we're just going down this road. And we can't turn, because if we did, we'd be, you know, going against this kind of principle that we've established. And so once they start making a mistake, they might even recognize them. People are saying, yo, we made a mistake. You'll have a number of voices throughout the Middle Ages. People like Bernard, people like other people. Later, we have people like Francis and the Dominicans who are going to say, we made a mistake. We need to change. This just doesn't make sense. We're doing things wrong. And the church is really going to be locked in because of its previous statements into, nope, this is where we have to go. This is the logical outcome of the decisions we've made before now. So veneration of Mary is going to be one of these. Ideas about the saints are going to be one of these. The physical presence of the body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper is going to be one of these. These are decisions that are kind of made a while back. And because the church can't err, we have to kind of go. And once we start down this road, there's only really one place that it's leading us. And you can kind of see that coming in a lot of things, especially with papal infallibility, which isn't going to come around until the middle of the 19th century. But you can start seeing it develop all the way back here with the idea of all my predecessors are saints. So obviously everything they said has to be infallible. So things like that. So it's just this, I mean, those type of decisions which are made for understandable reasons. It's understandable to understand why Gregory's making these claims. He's in the midst of this bitter struggle with Henry for control of the church. Right? Who's going to appoint the people who are going to lead the church? Shouldn't it be the Pope? We don't want the king, because he's going to appoint just political people. They're not going to take care of the church at all. It's a good, right? He has a good reason. It's just the methods and the things that he's going to grab at to really work through that and accomplish it are going to be things that are eventually going to lead to the downfall of the church. That's a sad thing, but I mean, that's just what's going to happen. That's why the popes, in seizing all this power and the way that they go about doing it, they're sowing the seeds for their own downfall. Not just in the theological problems that the church is going to get into, but it's not going to be long before the kings and emperors are going to have lawyers and clerks that are going to be religious people that are going to serve them just as faithfully as the Pope's clerks, and they're going to use everything that they know about canon law to start undercutting papal authority in service of the king. So while the kings might lose the first round, they're definitely going to end up winning the war in this way, and they're going to use the weapons that the church itself creates to defeat the church, because they're going to be able to use them much more ruthlessly, and they're going to be a lot better organized at it. Any other questions? Yeah, Bill.
Do we know of any enclaves of Christianity that were outside the Catholic Church at this time?
Well, obviously you have the Eastern Church, which is going to remain outside the Catholic Church, especially after the schism, so that you have that. Now, during this time period, you are going to have other things that are going to develop. You have the Cathars, or the Albigensians, which probably, they're not probably really Christians, they're heretics. They believe in some sort of new Manichaeistic, dualistic thing. You do have Peter Waldo and the Waldensians, though, that develop in southern France. I'll talk more about them next week, but they're going to be a reform movement that really develops towards the end of this period. And it's going to be one of the things that the Catholic Church is going to do with these new monastic movements. These new monastic movements are really like revivals that are going to spring up within the church. I want you to see that. Now, obviously, all of these, because they become institutionalized, are eventually going to end up becoming corrupt themselves and need more revivals and more revivals. But one of the things that the Catholic Church does after the Franciscans is it says, no more new religious orders. We're cutting this off. And that's because they're really worried about all these new revivals that are breaking out. In 1260, you get the flatulents who are, you know, going around beating themselves all over Europe and stirring up things. You have other people, you know, we have records of in Florence of just itinerant preachers that would go around and preach in Florence. So we have annals in the city records of Florence where it'll be like, this guy came and preached for 6 weeks and many people were saved. Or this guy went to these towns and he settled the conflicts of 97 homicides, you know, that these blood feuds that had developed between families. He kind of settled them. And a lot of that really stemmed from, this was a period, especially towards the end of this, you have, think about it, you have 40 to 50% of the population dead in 4 years. The end of the world is happening. Society is falling apart. And even before that, you had people that were predicting the end of the world in 1260 and a number of other years. You had these people that would go about, the world's going to end, society is going to end. And this keeps on happening all through this end of this period. And this is a period of just a lot of, you know, weird religious things, but a lot of really, you know, the Beguines, who are these women in Holland and northern Germany that just kind of separate themselves out and live very kind of simple, frugal lives of charity towards each other and towards others that are, you know, not a monastic community because they don't take monastic vows, but they live celibate lives and just live in community together. They buy their own house and just live there and serve the area around them. You have a number of men that develop. Any other questions? So you do have some, but it's not like an organized type of thing. That's not going to come until really you get to Hus and the Hussite Church in Czechoslovakia and Bohemia. Yeah.
And of course, at the micro level, more so than the macro level, mm-hmm. churches in France and Italy, on the question of Pato Communion, was that a practice that was still going on?
Pato Communion?
Did they think about things like discerning the body and blood of Christ?
You know, I haven't looked at that. I don't know. Obviously, Pato baptism is obviously going on during this time, but the idea of Pato communion within the Catholic Church is really something I haven't really looked at a whole lot. So I don't know if that's being practiced or not during this time period. I would assume probably not, because the church has structured itself fairly rigidly at this point as far as when you have communion and different things like that, with confirmation and all that kind of stuff has developed in the seven sacraments, and all that stuff is developed by this point. So I would say that that's probably not something that's going on, but that's just me kind of guessing. Yeah, Clint?
What else is going on besides, with Christianity, besides just what is in, you know, Europe and, you know, Eastern Asia?
Oh, that's a phenomenal question. So what else is going on in Christianity outside of this area? Well, during this time period of the Middle Ages, you have, well, of course, you have the Muslims who in 622, Muhammad is forced out of Mecca and goes to Medina, and and Islam begins spreading. So in the course of 100 years, you have Islam that spreads all the way from Arabia all the way to Spain and France and all the way to India in this 100-year period. And that's going to overcome a lot of ancient Christian civilizations that are there. So you have ancient Christian civilizations in Arabia before Muhammad arrives. You have ancient civilizations in, obviously, in Egypt and North Africa and Spain. But you also have Nestorian communities as far away as China and Japan. So when we talked about Nestorius yesterday, so they're diaphysites, the two natures of Christ that are completely separate. Their missionaries have spread all the way from what would be modern Syria and Armenia, all the way along that Silk Road, all the way through India to China. We have Nestorian churches in China that are very well attested to, and in Japan. And the Nestorian church in Japan is going to last all the way up until Japan is closed in the 1600s. And that's going to probably be the Japanese Nestorian church is going to be the most persecuted church probably in human history, in which they're all about probably between 60 and 200,000 Christians are systematically killed over a very short period. Now, there's still going to be some remnants of it left when Americans come back and Japan is reopened in the 1850s. But it's, I mean, Christianity, which was a very vibrant religion in Japan during this time period, is never, ever going to be a vibrant religion in Japan again. So that's some of the things that are going on outside that. But that's not Orthodox Christianity. That's either Monophysite or Nestorian Christianity. Any other questions we're going to... Yeah, go. All right. So, that's it. Thanks, guys.